From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Hello, and thanks for joining us for our weekly wrap-up of Connections. I'm Megan Mack. We'll start the podcast this week with a conversation we had with local refugees who are reacting to the Trump administration's policies related to immigration. It was a discussion about what being in America means to them and why they left their native countries to pursue better lives. Akhil Al-Jaish came to Rochester as a refugee after escaping 6 months of torture in an Iraqi prison. The government thought he was working with a group protesting Saddam Hussein, and one day, while he was studying at his university, he was arrested. In this clip, he talks about what he endured.
As soon as we exit the college main door, they tied me and put me in the back of the car. It was white car. And they said, there is two ways you can make it easy for us and just give us the list of the people that you meet with and the people that you work with. And or we can't get this from you anyway in hard time. We will give you hard time. So I said, I don't know what you're talking about. They said, you will know when we get there. So we get there and there is Major sitting there, and he started to question me. So we know everything about you. We know everything about your family. And we have tape recorder about you saying bad things about Saddam Hussein, and you guys planning to do uprising. And I said, I disagree with you, and if you have any tape or you have any evidence, just bring it. He said, I don't need to present this to you. You have to answer my question, and my question only. And they start investigating, actually start, one of them, he sitting behind me, so he hit me in my head really hard, and he said, listen, just answer what he said and give us the list, otherwise you will be tortured, and we will put you in a prison for maybe for your life. So I kept saying, I don't know anything about that. I don't have anything. Yes, I have so many friends in college, but we never talk about this or talk about the government. And they said, okay, so give us the list of your friend. I said, I don't remember. Like, it's not a friend. It's like a classmate. And I cannot give you 45 classmates. I've been taking a class with. If you need it, go to the college. They will give you this list. And so spending about an hour or so, they took me and they put me in a small bathroom, which is barely you can stand. It's actually not bathroom. It's just like you could stand on it. You cannot sit. And they lock the door. And they call me back after 2 hours. The guy who was interviewing me is changed. Other shifts come in. So, and they start saying, okay, you have to tell us you have just today. It was like about noon time when they took me. So they said, you have today till 7 o'clock, and you don't need to go beyond 7 o'clock because you will regret it to the rest of your life. You have to tell us. I said, ask me about anything I know, but if you want to ask me about something I know, I cannot pretend or write a story for you. And they said, okay. So they bring some picture for me. Do you know this guy? Do you know this? Do you know that? I said no. And then they bring me some pictures for people who's really been beaten. And they said, see, this is one of those people that refuse to talk. Do you want to be like that? And you cannot see even the eye and the face and nose. And they start torturing me.
They started to torture you?
Yeah.
What was the worst of the damage? I see, I'm looking at your fingers. You lost parts of your fingers?
This is not the beginning. The beginning was like they tied you from the back, your hand backward, and there's a guy who is taking you to the other room and start beating you with the cable. And also they have this kind of about 1-inch hose and or half inch hose and a plastic hose filled with a stone inside it.
Oh.
Yeah. So they start beating you and, you keep screaming and I don't know nothing and they will never stop. And the other guy came in and put you on the wall and start punch you in the face and kick you between your leg and your stomach. And they when you get really kind of, you cannot stand, they kind of refresh you with, they put cold water in your face so you just to wake up. And they said, okay, give us at least one name or two names. And they keep doing that.
Did you think you were going to die?
At that point, actually, I don't know what's going on, but as far as I know, I don't have anything to tell them, and I cannot just give them any name because I know what will happen.
Yeah.
So basically, it's kind of between you collecting what's going on, thinking what's going on, and start thinking about my family and how my dad and my mom, how they will handle that when they hear I'm being took by the government.
So you were in prison for 6 months, and then what's the short version of how you got released? Why were you released from prison?
It's actually after they tortured me and cutting my two fingers. My dad, he knows a lot of people around, and he is one known person there, and he has a lot of land. He owns a lot of land over there. So he starts looking for somebody to pay bribe to get me out. And in the final, he finds somebody and pay the money, and they get me out.
Next, what can Americans learn from urbanism in cities around the world? It's a question two world travelers discussed on our show this week. Howard Decker is a board member for the Community Design Center in Rochester, and we have some good-natured fun with him from time to time about his aversion to cars. He's a fan of cities like Florence in Italy and Freiburg in Germany, where cars are banned from city centers. Howard joined us on the show to discuss the lessons he thinks Rochester can take from international cities. You'll hear from him and from Jackie Marchand. She's the owner of a women's-only bike touring company that does international trips. Here's Howard Decker.
We need to create a junket, and we need to take Rochesterians to a couple of places in the world where they wouldn't feel threatened.
Okay.
They wouldn't feel like they were somewhere that was so weird that they couldn't understand it, or that people were all looked weird or were wearing weird clothes or eating weird food. One of the first places that I would take everybody is Melbourne. In Australia, Melbourne, probably the best transit system on earth. And it's not just a subway, but it's trains, buses, streetcars, some bike paths. It's a whole host of tools, if you will. And the city works great. And I don't think anybody in Melbourne, I mean, the people that we know, our friends in Melbourne, they have a car and people drive cars in Melbourne. So your earlier caller who was worried about, you know, what might happen if all the, well, you know, people in Melbourne, they think cars are fine, but they find it easier to move around their city, and they find it easier to enjoy each other in their city by other modes. So we could take people around to various places and show them cities that really work great, cities that are not so wildly foreign to a Rochesterian that they would feel threatened by it. Paris is another perfectly good example of a city that it works great. So, yeah, there are many cities that work great, and there are plenty of them that are, in fact, very foreign. But it's very easy to take people around and show them what it means when it works well.
Well, you know, I'm just going to challenge you on one point. As you said, if you add more car lanes, what happens, Howard?
More traffic.
Yeah, but if you added 100 lanes on both sides, then maybe you would have
more traffic. Look,
even 100,
Evan,
1,000 lanes, Howard.
When you go to Beijing, you cross the 10th.
I want 7 miles of car lanes on both sides for every
go
street.
To Beijing. You got it. Right? In Beijing, the 10th ring road. The 10th ring road. Not the inner loop. The 10th ring road has 20 lanes.
Wow.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, we could just keep building more and more lanes, and we'll have, of course, as a direct result, more and more traffic. So that clearly doesn't work.
So you have choices. And as we've been pointing out, as we look around the world, the Madrids of the world are making these choices. Howard is back from India, where they've had a lot of choices to make. Christchurch, New Zealand is a city that had to rebuild infrastructure and could have gone in a couple of different directions. I'll start with you, Howard. What's the lesson from Christchurch?
Well, Christchurch had a horrible tragedy. It had a very violent earthquake, and much of the city was destroyed and many lives were lost. The people in Christchurch were faced with a challenge. We need to rebuild our city. We have at least two choices. We can rebuild our city with an eye towards creating a resilient, sustainable, wonderful place that's not like anything we've ever seen before, but fits us best for our future. Or we can choose to build Christchurch back just the way it was as fast as we can. And those seem like two very understandable choices. Unfortunately, Christchurchians chose the second option, and they have built back Christchurch it's almost done now. Not quite. There's still plenty of things yet to do there, but much of it is complete now. And it's filled with sprawl. There's cars everywhere, strip shopping malls, and all the kind of junk which we normally associate with the worst of city making that you can imagine. So they had a chance, but it didn't quite work out. And it's really a shame because Christchurch could have been, it's a really interesting place, and it could have been sensational.
Jackie, if you were on a planning board in Christchurch, what would you have told them?
Well, I think that was part of the problem. I mean, I'm not intimately involved. I don't know what happened, but I was there in between Howard's first visit and his most recent visit, and I saw it in the process, and I thought, where is the plan? Mm-hmm. Where is the grand plan here? You could just see there were bits and pieces of work being redone, of buildings being rehabbed, some being just gated around with, you know, do not enter signs, and others being run up with cardboard and sustainable products that would that were going to fall apart within a year. And it's just, it's sad because, as Howard says, it was a, had a huge potential to become a really major international city, and I think it's missed its chance.
Did you have any conversations with people there about that? Did they seem happy with the progress at the time?
No, frustrated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, very frustrated.
Next, a question. Are you willing to nuke your neighbors? Probably not, but if you're a political centrist, would you consider it? It's a very strange way to lead into our next conversation, but it'll make sense in a moment. We had a conversation about whether centrism is dying in politics. One of our guests was Doug Jay, a college professor and an analyst for the political website Balloon Juice. He says centrism has become a way for wealthy liberals and conservatives to feel good about themselves. But he also leaves room for what he calls a good kind of centrism. Let's listen.
Centrism is a form of nihilism in the sense that all it is triangulating your way between two other sets of beliefs. It doesn't matter what those beliefs are, you know. If one of them is we should nuke everybody, and the other is we should nuke nobody, the centrist would say, let's nuke maybe half the country. That would be what's sensible.
It's the Thanos position.
Yeah. It's just halfway in between. And I agree. I think that kind of centrism really is a form of nihilism. And I think that when people say centrism in a negative way, that is to some extent what they're referring to.
And that's what you are referring to, usually.
Well, it's a combination, actually. It's a combination of that. And also the sort of people talk about norms all the time now, civility. I don't like that kind of centrism either. I feel like that's like knowing which dinner fork to use centrism. And that, I think, is equally, you know, bereft of any policy ideas. It's like if somebody's polite, somebody drops the F-bomb, whoa, even if they dropped it in defense of Bull Simpson itself, the holy grail of centrism, that would still be bad to a centrist. Because what really matters is...
Because it's rude.
It's rude.
All right, so what is, in your reading then, I guess for lack of a better term, the good kind of centrism?
I think open-mindedness is really important. It's a little bit complicated. The thing I really don't like about centrism is it's when it becomes kind of glib, like just taking the middle position no matter what. But they're not the only ones out there who are glib. There's a whole term, glibertarian, right? Libertarians who are just like, yeah, whatever, you know, whatever, man, sort of. And then there's also, I think that I actually see a lot of people really to the left of me who are kind of glib too, the sort of Marxists where like everything is like, oh well, that's just late stage capitalism. I'm not gonna shed any tears for these kids in cages. That's just how late stage capitalism works.
And or neoliberalism.
I think there's a lot of ways to be glib, and I think centrism can be glib and sort of set in its ways. But I think on the flip side, this type of what the article called procedural centrism is supposed to be kind of the opposite of that, where you really do care about issues, but you're open minded. You don't care where the idea is coming from.
But you're not just choosing a middle position on an issue.
No, but here's kind of an example of maybe the kind of something I sort of thought of the other day. The Vox, it's basically a liberal kind of wonky online magazine.
News analysis.
Has really gotten behind this guaranteed universal income, right? And if you really think about it, it's really a very libertarian idea because it's money to people, no strings attached, right? The more classical sort of liberal approach would be, you know, means testing, all kinds of stuff to make sure only quote-unquote deserving people get it. And this sort of really cuts that away and is just give money to everybody. And they argue for it, I think, quite convincingly. And I think it's a really good example of the good kind of centrism. They're not libertarians at Vox. This idea really sort of originated with libertarians, but they looked at it, they liked it, and now they're promoting it. And that's, to me, is the good kind of centrism.
We'll close with some music. The biggest pop hit in the country this summer is a song called The Middle. Maybe you've heard it. It has 7 credited writers and several teams of producers. And that inspired us to bring in local recording artists to better understand the process of making music. Michaela Davis just released her new album. It's called Delivery. She's a Rochester-based vocalist and harp player, and she writes her own music. But the music industry has a way of pushing artists like Michaela to come up with radio-friendly hits. We'll start this clip with Michaela's new single, Other Lover.
Michaela, tell us about this one.
I actually chose this song because it is the one song on my album that is a co-write between 3 people and maybe the least authentic quote-unquote song on my album. And there's a very long story with this song. So I wrote it with 2 of my friends in Nashville 4 years ago, I think. Mm-hmm. 2 producers in Nashville. And we just made a little demo of it and sent it to my manager. And I kind of thought, I came up with the like, da 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 da, that kind of line, and like, I don't want to be the other lover, and didn't really know what to do with it. And they helped me finish it. And when we sent it to my manager, I was thinking, I don't know if I can sing this song. Same thing, I thought, this someone else should sing this song because it's just not me. My manager called me and was like, no way, this song is awesome, I'm moving and grooving. And so anyway, they convinced me to record it. I've recorded it 4 times. I recorded it once with those 2 producers, but then I got picked up by a label and they asked me to write more songs and re-record. That was the one song that made it from 2014. I recorded it with a producer, John Congleton, in Dallas, along with my whole record and my bandmates, Alex and Shane. And I didn't think it was going to be the single, and my label said, actually, no, this is still the single. It's still the catchiest song, but we want you to re-record it again because they didn't like it. It wasn't radio-friendly enough, per se. I was very frustrated, but I did it because I'm a new artist and I need to eat, and I want to, yeah, if it's going to get on radio, like, heck yes, I will do it. So I went back and re-recorded it in L.A. with John again, but this time I used different. I used a drummer, Zach Dawes, who plays with like the Arctic Monkeys and stuff like that, and then the drummer's Joey Wanaker, who plays for Robert Plant and Beck and other people like that. So it was really a very. I mean, it went through 4 different producers, 2 different bands. It just went through a lot to get to where it is today. And now I understand what it's like to try and make a pop hit, and it's pretty crazy. And I don't know, instead of being mad about it, I can relate to people. Not that it is a pop hit, but it's just a long process.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM. And of course, you can also hear us on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you Monday. Have a great weekend, everyone.